seem to be tangible artifacts of the life that she and I, by rights, ought to be living together. I wrote 30-page emails to her that I erased without sending, opting instead for the mathematical formula I'd devised to keep from making too big a fool of myself. Always 3 lines shorter than the email she'd sent, always 1 day longer than I'd waited for her reply. Sometimes in bed, adrift in my sighing, opiated, erotic reveries, I carried on long, candid conversations with her. "We are inseparable," I imagined us saying, cornily to each other, each with a hand on the other's cheek. "We can never be apart." Like a stalker, I hoarded a snippet of autumn leaf hair I'd retrieved from the trash after she'd trimmed her bangs in the bathroom. And, even more creepily, an unwashed shirt, still intoxicating with her haze-smelling, vegetarian sweat. It was hopeless. More than hopeless. Humiliating. Always leaving the door of my room partially open when she came to visit. A not-so-subtle invitation. Even the adorable drag in her step, like the Little Mermaid, too fragile to walk on land, drove me crazy. She was the golden thread running through everything, a lens that magnified beauty so that the whole world stood transfigured in relation to her and her alone. Twice I'd tried to kiss her, once drunk in a taxicab, once at the airport, desperate at the thought that I would not be seeing her again for months, or, who knew, years. "I'm sorry," I said, a beat too late.
"It's okay."
"No, really, I..."
"Listen."
Sweet, unfocused smile.
"It's fine. But they're boarding my flight soon."
They weren't, in fact.
"I have to go. Take care of yourself, okay?"
Take care. What on earth did she see in this Everett? I could only think how boring she must find me if she preferred such a lukewarm gloop of a guy to me.
"Someday, when we have kids..."
Though he'd said it half-jokingly, my blood had gone cold. He was just the kind of loser you could see hauling around a diaper bag and loads of padded baby equipment. I berated myself for not being more forceful with her. Though in truth, there was no way I could have pursued her any harder without at least a tiny bit of encouragement on her end. Already it was embarrassing enough. Hobie's tact whenever her name came up, the careful flatness in his voice. Yet my longing for her was like a bad cold that had hung on for years, despite my conviction that I was sure to get over it at any moment. Even a cow like Mrs. Vogel could see it. It wasn't as if Pippa had led me on. Quite the contrary. If she cared anything about me, she would have come back to New York instead of staying in Europe after school. And still, for whatever dumb reason, I couldn't let go of the way she'd looked at me the day when I first came to visit. Sitting on the side of her bed. The memory of that childhood afternoon had sustained me for years. It was as if, sick with loneliness for my mother, I'd imprinted on her like some orphaned animal, when in fact, joke on me, she'd been doped up and knocked lamb daffy from a head injury, ready to throw her arms around the first stranger who'd walked in. My opes, as Jerome called them, were in an old tobacco tin. On the marble top of the dresser, I crushed one of my hoarded, old-style Oxycontins, cut it, and drew it into lines with my Christie's card, and, rolling the crispest bill in my wallet, leaned to the table, eyes damp with anticipation. Ground zero. Bam. Bitter taste in the back of the throat, and then the gust of relief. Falling backward on the bed as the sweet old punch hit me square in the heart. Pure pleasure, aching and bright, far from the tin can clatter of misery. 7. The night of my dinner at the barber's was rain-whipped and stormy, with blasting winds so strong I could scarcely get my umbrella up. On 6th Avenue there were no cabs to be had. Pedestrians head down and shouldering into sideways rain. In the humid, bunker-like damp of the subway platform, drips plinked monotonously from the concrete ceiling. When I emerged, Lexington Avenue was deserted, raindrops dancing and prickling on the sidewalks, a smashing rain that seemed to amplify all the noise on the streets. Taxis lashed by in loud sprays of water. A few doors from the station, I ducked into a market to buy flowers. Lilies. Three bunches since one was too puny. In the tiny, overheated shop, their fragrance hit me exactly the wrong way, and only at the cash register did I realize why. Their scent was the same sick, unwholesome sweetness of my mother's memorial service. As I ducked out again and ran the flooded sidewalk to Park Avenue, socks squelching, cold rain pelting in my face, I regretted I'd bought them at all and came close to tossing them in a trash can, only the squalls of rain were so fierce I couldn't bring myself to slow down for even a moment, and ran on. Standing in the vestibule, my hair plastered to my head, my supposedly waterproof raincoat sopping like I'd soaked it in the bathtub, the door opened quite suddenly to a large, open-faced college kid that it took me a pulse or two to recognize as Toddy. Before I could apologize for the water streaming off me, he embraced me solidly with a clap on the back. "Oh my God," he was saying as he led me into the living room. "Let me take your coat. And these, oh, Mom will love them. Awesome to see you. How long has it been?" He was larger and more robust than Platt, with unbarber-like hair of a darker, cardboard-colored blonde, and a very unbarber-like smile on him as well, eager and bright, with no irony about it. "Well..." His warmth, which seemed to presume upon some happy old intimacy we did not share, had thrown me into awkwardness. "It's been a long time. You must be in college now, right?"
"Yes, Georgetown, up for the weekend. I'm studying political science, but really, I'm hoping to go into nonprofit management, maybe. Something to do with young people?"
With his ready, student government smile, he had clearly grown up to be the high achiever that, at one time, Platt had promised to be. "And I mean, I hope it's not too weird of me to say, but I have you in part to thank for it."
"Sorry?"
"Well, I mean, wanting to work with disadvantaged young people. You made quite an impression on me, you know, back when you were staying with us all those years ago. It was a real eye-opener, your situation. Because even back in third grade or whatever, you made me think that this was what I wanted to do someday, you know? Something to do with helping kids."
"Wow,"
I said, still stuck on the disadvantaged part.
"Huh, that's great. And, I mean, it's really exciting, because there are so many ways to give back to youth out there in need. I mean, I don't know how familiar you are with DC, but there are lots of underserved neighborhoods. I'm involved in a service project tutoring at-risk kids in reading and math, and this summer I'm going to Haiti with Habitat for Humanity."
"Is that him?"
Decorous click of shoes on the parquet, light fingertips on my sleeve, and the next thing I knew, Kitsy had her arms around me, and I was smiling down into her white blonde hair.
"Oh, you're completely soaked,"
she was saying, holding me out at arm's length.
"Look at you. How on earth did you get here? Did you swim?"
She had Mr. Barber's long, fine nose and his bright, almost goofy clarity of gaze, much the same as when she was a straggle-haired 9-year-old in school uniform, flushed and struggling with her backpack. Only now, when she looked at me, I went blank to see how coldly, impersonally beautiful she'd grown. To hide my confusion, I looked back at Toddy, busy with raincoat and flowers.
"Sorry. This is just so weird. I mean, you especially,"
to Toddy. "How old were you the last time I saw you? 7? 8?
"I know," said Kitsy. "The little rat. He's so exactly like a person now, isn't he? Platt."
Platt had ambled into the living room, poorly shaven, in tweeds and rough Donegal sweater, like some gloomy fisherman in a singe play.
"Where does she want us?"
He seemed embarrassed, rubbing his stubbled cheek. "Back in her quarters, actually. You don't mind, do you?" he said to me. "Etta's set up a table back there." Kitsy wrinkled her brow.
"Oh, rats. Well, it's okay, I guess. Why don't you put the dogs in the kitchen? Come on."
seizing me by the hand and dragging me down the hall with a sort of madcap, fluttery, forward-leaning quality.
We have to get you a drink. You'll need one.
There was something of Andy in her fixity of gaze, also her breathlessness. His asthmatic gape reconfigured, delightfully, into parted lips and a sort of whispery, starlet quality.
I was hoping she'd have us in the living room, or at least the kitchen. It's so gruesome back in her lair. What are you drinking?
She said, turning into the bar off the pantry where glasses and a bucket of ice were set out. Some of that Stolichnaya would be great. On the rocks, please.
Really? Are you sure it's all right?
We none of us drink it.
Daddy always ordered this kind,
hoisting Stoli bottle,
because he liked the label. Very Cold War. How do you say it again?
Stolichnaya.
Very authentic sounding. Won't even try. You know,
she said, turning the gooseberry gray eyes to me,
I was afraid you wouldn't come.
It's not that bad out.
Yes, but...
Blink, blink.
I thought you hated us.
Hated you?
No.
No? When she laughed, it was fascinating to see Andy's leukemic wanness in her, remodeled and prettified, the candy floss twinkle of a Disney princess.
But I was so awful.
I didn't care. Good. After a too long pause, she turned back to the drinks.
We were horrible to you,
she said flatly.
Todd and me.
Come on. You two were just little.
Yes, but...
She bit her lower lip.
We knew better. Especially after what had happened to you. And now, I mean, with Daddy and Andy.
I waited, as it seemed she was trying to formulate a thought. But instead she only took a sip of her wine. White. Pippa drank red. Then touched me on the back of the wrist.
Mom's waiting to see you,
she said.
She's been so excited all day. Shall we go in?
Certainly. Lightly, lightly, I put my hand at her elbow, as I had seen Mr. Barber do with guests of the female persuasion, and steered her into the hall. 8. The night was a dreamlike mangle of past and present. A childhood world miraculously intact in some respects, grievously altered in others, as if the ghost of Christmas past and the ghost of Christmas yet to come had joined to host the evening. But despite the continual ugly scrape of Andy's absence, Andy and I, remember when Andy and everything else so altered and shrunken, pot pies at a folding table in Mrs. Barber's room? The oddest part of the evening was my blood-deep, unreasoning sense of returning home. Even Etta, when I'd gone back to the kitchen to say hi, had untied her apron and rushed to hug me. I had the night off, but I wanted to stay. I wanted to see you. Toddie, it's Todd now, please, had risen to his father's position as captain of the table, guiding the conversation with a slightly automatic-seeming but evidently sincere charm, although Mrs. Barber hadn't really been interested in talking to anyone but me. About Andy, a little, but mostly about her family's furniture, a few pieces of which had been purchased from Israel Sack in the 1940s, but most of which had come down through her family from colonial times, rising from the table at one point mid-meal and leading me off by the hand to show me a set of chairs and a mahogany lowboy, Queen Anne, Salem, Massachusetts, that had been in her mother's family since the 1760s. Salem, I thought. Were these Phipps ancestors of hers witch burners? Or witches themselves? Apart from Andy, cryptic, isolated, self-sufficient, incapable of dishonesty and completely lacking in both malice and charisma, the other barbers, even Todd, all had something slightly uncanny about them. A watchful, sly amalgam of decorum and mischief that made it all too easy to imagine their forebears gathering in the forest by night, casting off their Puritan garb to frolic by the pagan bonfire. Kitsy and I hadn't talked much. We hadn't been able to, thanks to Mrs. Barber, but almost every time I'd glanced in her direction, I'd been aware of her eyes on me. Platt, voice thick after 5, 6, large gin and limes, pulled me aside at the bar after dinner and said, She's on antidepressants.
Oh? I said, taken aback.
Kitsy, I mean. Mommy won't touch them.
Well, his lowered voice made me uncomfortable, as if he was seeking my opinion or wanting me to weigh in somehow. I hope they work better for her than they did for me.
Platt opened his mouth and then seemed to reconsider.
Oh, reeling back slightly, I suppose she's bearing up, but it's been rough for her. Kits was very close to both of them. Closer to Andy, I would say, than any of us.
Oh, really?
Close would not have been my description of their relationship in childhood, though she, more than Andy's brothers, had always been in the background, if only to whine or tease.
Platt sighed, a gin-crocked blast that almost knocked me over.
Yeah, she's on a leave of absence from Wellesley. Not sure if she'll go back. Maybe she'll take some classes at the new school. Maybe she'll get a job. Too hard for her being in Massachusetts after, you know. They saw an awful lot of each other in Cambridge. She feels rotten, of course, that she didn't go up to see after Daddy. She was better with Daddy than anyone else, but there was a party. She phoned Andy and begged him to go up instead.
Well, shit.
I stood appalled at the bar, ice tongs in hand, feeling sick to think of another person ruined by the same poison of why did I and if only that had wrecked my own life.
Yep, said Platt, pouring himself another hefty slug of gin. Rough stuff.
Well, she shouldn't blame herself.
She can't. That's crazy. I mean,
I said, unnerved by the watery, dead-eye look Platt was giving me over the top of his drink.
If she'd been on that boat, she'd be the dead one now, not him.
No, she wouldn't, Platt said flatly. Kitts is a crackerjack sailor. Good reflexes. Good head on her shoulders ever since she was tiny.
Andy was thinking about his orbit resonances or whatever computational shite he was doing back at home on his laptop, and he spazzed out in the pinch. Completely fucking typical.
Anyway, he continued calmly, not appearing to notice my astonishment at this remark.
She's a bit at loose ends right now, as I'm sure you'll understand. You should ask her to dinner or something. It would thrill Mommy senseless.
9. By the time I left, after 11, the rain had stopped and the streets were glassy with water, and Kenneth the Nightman, same heavy eyes and malt liquor smell, bigger in the stomach but otherwise unchanged, was on the door.
Don't be a stranger, eh?
He said, which was the same thing he'd always said when I was a little kid and my mother came to pick me up after sleepovers. Same torpid voice, just a half beat too slow. Even in some smoky, post-catastrophe Manhattan, you could imagine him swaying genially at the door in the rags of his former uniform, the barbers up in the apartment burning old National Geographics for warmth, living off gin and tinned crab meat. Though it had pervaded every aspect of the evening like a simmering toxin, Andy's death was still too huge to grasp. Though the strange thing, too, was how inevitable it seemed in hindsight, how weirdly predictable, almost as if he'd suffered from some fatal inborn defect. Even as a 6-year-old, dreamy, stumbling, asthmatic, hopeless, the slur of misfortune and early demise had been perfectly visible about his rickety little person, marking him off like a cosmic kick me sign pinned to his back. And yet it was remarkable, too, how his world limped on without him. Strange, I thought, as I jumped a sheet of water at the curb, how a few hours could change everything. Or rather, how strange to find that the present contained such a bright shard of the living past, damaged and eroded, but not destroyed. Andy had been good to me when I had no one else. The least I could do was be kind to his mother and sister. It didn't occur to me then, though it certainly does now, that it was years since I'd roused myself from my stupor of misery and self-absorption. Between anomie and trance, inertia and parenthesis, and gnawing my own heart out, there were a lot of small, easy, everyday kindnesses I'd missed out on. And even the word kindness was like rising from unconsciousness into some hospital awareness of voices and people,
from a stream of digitized machines. 10. An every other day habit was still a habit, as Jerome had often reminded me, particularly when I didn't stick too faithfully to the every other day part. New York was full of all kinds of daily subway and crowd horror. The suddenness of the explosion had never left me. I was always looking for something to happen, always expecting it just out of the corner of my eye. Certain configurations of people in public places could trigger it. A wartime urgency, someone cutting in front of me the wrong way, or walking too fast at a particular angle, was enough to throw me into tachycardia and trip hammer panic, the kind that made me stumble for the nearest park bench, and my dad's painkillers, which had started as relief for my nigh-on uncontrollable anxiety, provided such a rapturous escape that soon I'd started taking them as a treat. First an only-on-weekends treat, then an after-school treat, then the purring, etherous bliss that welcomed me whenever I was unhappy or bored, which was, unfortunately, quite a lot, at which time I made the earth-shaking discovery that the tiny pills I'd ignored because they were so insignificant and weak-looking were literally 10 times as strong as the Vicodins and Percocets I'd been downing by the handful. Oxycontins, 80s, strong enough to kill someone without a tolerance, which person by that point was definitely not me. And when at last my endless seeming trove of oral narcotics ran out shortly before my 18th birthday, I'd been forced to start buying on the street. Even dealers were censorious of the sums I spent, thousands of dollars every few weeks. Jack, Jerome's predecessor, had scolded me about it repeatedly even as he sat in the filthy beanbag chair from which he conducted his business, counting my hundreds fresh from the teller's window. Might as well light it on fire, brah. Heroin was cheaper, $15 a bag. Even if I didn't bang it, Jack laboriously had done the math for me on the inside of a quarter-pounder wrapper. I would be looking at a much more reasonable expenditure, something in the neighborhood of $450 a month. But heroin I only did on offer, a bump here, a bump there. As much as I loved it and craved it constantly, I never bought it. There would never be a reason to stop. With pharmaceuticals, on the other hand, the expense was a helpful factor, since it not only kept my habit in control, but provided an excellent reason for me to go downstairs and sell furniture every day. It was a myth you couldn't function on opiates. Shooting up was one thing, but for someone like me, jumping at pigeons beating from the sidewalk, afflicted with post-traumatic stress syndrome practically to the point of spasticity and cerebral palsy, pills were the key to being not only competent, but high-functioning. Booze made people sloppy and unfocused. All you had to do was look at Platt Barber sitting around at J.G. Mellon at 3 o'clock in the afternoon feeling sorry for himself. As for my dad, even after he'd sobered up, he'd retained the faint clumsiness of a punch-drunk boxer, butterfingered with a phone or a kitchen timer. Wet brain, people called it. The mental damage from hardcore drinking. Neurological stuff that never went away. He'd been seriously screwy in his reasoning, never able to hold down any kind of a long-term job. Me, well, maybe I didn't have a girlfriend or even any non-drug friends to speak of, but I worked 12 hours a day. Nothing stressed me out. I wore Tom Brown suits, socialized smilingly with people I couldn't stand, swam twice a week, and played tennis on occasion, stayed away from sugar and processed foods. I was relaxed and personable. I was as thin as a rail. I did not indulge in self-pity or negative thinking of any kind. I was an excellent salesman. Everyone said so. And business was so good that what I spent on drugs, I scarcely missed. Not that I hadn't had a few lapses. Unpredictable glides where things flashed out of control for a few eerie blinks like an ice skid on a bridge. And I saw just how badly things could go, how quick. It wasn't a matter of money. More a matter of escalating doses, forgetting I'd sold pieces, or forgetting to send bills. Hobie looking at me funny when I'd overdone things and come downstairs a bit too glassy and out of it. Dinner parties, clients. Sorry, were you talking to me? Did you just say something? No, just a little tired. coming down with something. Maybe I'll go to bed a little early, folks. I'd inherited my mother's light-colored eyes, which, short of sunglasses at gallery openings, made it pretty much impossible to hide pinned pupils. Not that anyone in Hobie's crowd seemed to notice, except sometimes a few of the younger, more with-it gay guys.
"You're a bad boy,"
the bodybuilder boyfriend of a client had whispered into my ear at a formal dinner, freaking me out thoroughly. And I dreaded going up to the accounts department at one of the auction houses, because one of the guys there, older, British, an addict himself, was always hitting on me. Of course, it happened with women, too. One of the girls I slept with, the fashion intern, I'd met in the small dog run in Washington Square with Popchick, it being rapidly apparent to both of us after 30 seconds on the park bench that we shared the same condition. Whenever things started getting out of hand, I'd dialed it back, and I'd even quit altogether a number of times, the longest for a 6-week stretch. Not everyone was able to do that, I told myself. It was simply a matter of discipline. But at this point, in the spring of my 26th year, I had not been more than 3 days clean in a row in over 3 years. I'd worked out how to quit for good, if I wanted to. Steep taper, 7-day timetable, plenty of loperamide, magnesium supplements and free-form amino acids to replenish my burnt-out neurotransmitters, protein powder, electrolyte powder, melatonin, and weed for sleep, as well as various herbal tinctures and potions my fashion intern swore by, licorice root and milk thistle, nettles and hops and black cumin seed oil, valerian root and skullcap extract. I had a shopping bag from the health food store with all the stuff I needed, which had been sitting on the floor at the back of my closet for 1.5 years. All of it was mostly untouched, except the weed, which was long gone. The problem, as I'd learned repeatedly, was that 36 hours in, with your body in full revolt, and the remainder of your unopiated life stretching out bleakly ahead of you like a prison corridor, you needed some fairly compelling reason to keep moving forward into grayness, pain, despair, rather than falling straight back into the gorgeous feather mattress you'd so foolishly abandoned. That night when I got home from the barber's, I swallowed a long-acting morphine tablet, as was my habit whenever I happened to come home in a remorseful mood and feeling I needed to straighten up. Low dose, less than half of what I needed to feel anything, just enough on top of the booze to keep me from being too agitated to sleep. The next morning, losing heart, for usually waking up sick at this phase of the kick plan, I very quickly lost my nerve. I crushed 30 and then 60 milligrams of Roxycodone on the marble top of the nightstand, which I inhaled through a cut straw, then, unwilling to flush the rest of the pills, well over $2,000 worth, got up, dressed, flushed my nose with saline spray, and after squirreling away a few more of the long-acting morphs in case the withdrawals, as Jerome called them, got too uncomfortable, slipped the red-breast flake tin in my pocket, and, at 6 a.m., before Hobie awoke, took a cab up to the storage facility. The storage facility, open 24 hours, was like a Mayan burial complex, save for an empty-eyed clerk watching TV at the front desk. Nervously, I walked to the elevators. I had only set foot on the premises 3 times in 7 years, always with dread, and then never venturing upstairs to the locker itself, but only executing a quick duck in the lobby to pay the rent in cash. 2 years' rent at a time, the maximum allowed by state law. The freight elevator required a key card, which fortunately I'd remembered to bring. Unfortunately, it failed to engage properly, and, for several minutes, hoping that the desk clerk was too out of it to notice, I stood in the open elevator trying to finesse the card slide until the steel doors hissed and slid shut. Feeling jittery and observed, doing my best to avert my face from my fuzzed-out shadow on the monitor, I rode to the 8th floor, 8D, 8E, 8F, 8G, cinder block walls, and rows of faceless doors, like some prefab eternity where there was no color but beige, and no dust would settle for the rest of time. 8R. Two keys and a combination padlock. 7522. The last four digits of Boris's home phone in Vegas. The locker creaked with a metallic squeal. There was the shopping bag from Paragon Sporting Goods. Tag of the pup tent dangling. King Canopy, $43.99. Just as crisp and new-looking as the day I'd bought it 7 years before. And though the texture of the pillowcase peeking out of the bag threw me an ugly short circuit, like an electric pop in the temple, more than anything I was struck by the smell. For the plastic, pool liner odor of masking tape had grown overwhelming from being shut up in such a small space, an emotionally evocative odor I hadn't remembered or thought of in years, a distinct polyvinyl reek that threw me straight back to childhood in my bedroom back in Vegas. Chemicals and new carpet, falling asleep and waking up every morning with the painting taped behind my headboard and the same adhesive smell in my nostrils. I had not properly unwrapped it in years. Just to get it open would take 10 or 15 minutes with an X-Acto knife. But as I stood there overwhelmed, slippage and confusion, almost like the time I'd waked, sleepwalking, in the door of Pippa's bedroom, I didn't know what I'd been thinking or what I ought to do. I was transfixed with an urge amounting almost to delirium. For to have it only a hand's breadth away again, after so long, was to find myself suddenly on some kind of dangerous, yearning edge I hadn't even known was there. In the shadows, the mummified bundle, what little was visible, had a ragged, poignant, oddly personal look. Less like an inanimate object than some poor creature bound and helpless in the dark, unable to cry out and dreaming of rescue. I hadn't been so close to the painting since I was 15 years old. And for a moment, it was all I could do to keep from snatching it up and tucking it under my arm and walking out with it. But I could feel the security cameras hissing at my back, and, quick, spasmodic movement, I dropped my Redbreast Flake tin in the Bloomingdale's bag and shut the door and turned the key. "Just flush them if you ever want really to kick," Jerome's extremely hot girlfriend Maya had advised me. "Else your ass is going to be up at that storage unit at 2 in the morning. But as I walked out the door, lightheaded and buzzed, the drugs were the last thing on my mind. Just the sight of the bundled painting, lonely and pathetic, had scrambled me top to bottom, as if a satellite signal from the past had burst in and jammed all other transmissions. 11. Though my sometime days off had kept my dose from escalating too much, the withdrawals got uncomfortable sooner than I'd expected, and even with the pills I had saved to taper, I spent the next days feeling pretty low. Too sick to eat, unable to stop sneezing. "Just a cold," I told Hobie. "I'm fine." "Nope. If you've got a bad stomach, it's the flu," said Hobie grimly, just back from Bigelow with more Benadryl and Imodium, plus crackers and ginger ale from Jefferson Market. "There's not a reason on earth, bless you. If I were you, I'd get myself to the doctor and no fuss about it." "Look, it's just a bug." Hobie had an iron constitution. Whenever he came down with anything himself, he drank a Fernet Branca and kept going.
"Maybe. But you've eaten hardly a bite in days. There's no point scraping away down here and making yourself miserable."
But working took my mind off my discomfort. The chills came in 10-minute spasms, and then I was sweating. Runny nose, runny eyes, startling electrical twitches. The weather had turned. The shop was full of people, murmur and drift. The trees flowering on the streets outside were white pops of delirium. My hands were steady at the register, for the most part, but inside I was squirming.
"Your first rodeo isn't the bad one," Maya had told me. "It's around the third or fourth you'll start wishing you were dead."
My stomach flopped and seethed like a fish on the hook. Aches, jumpy muscles. I couldn't lie still or get comfortable in bed, and nights, after I closed the shop, I sat red-faced and sneezing in a tub almost too hot to stand, a glass of ginger ale and mostly melted ice pressed to my temple, while Popchick, too stiff and creaky to stand with his paws on the edge of the tub, as he had once liked to do, sat on the bath mat and watched me anxiously. None of this was as bad as I'd feared, but what I hadn't expected to hit even a quarter so hard was what Maya called the mental stuff, which was unendurable, a sopping black curtain of horror. Maya, Jerome, my fashion intern, most of my drug friends had been at it longer than I had, and when they sat around high and talking about what it was like to quit, which was apparently the only time they could stand to talk about quitting, everyone had warned me repeatedly that the physical symptoms weren't the rough part, that even with a baby habit like mine, the depression would be like nothing I'd ever dreamed, and I'd smiled politely as I leaned to the mirror and thought, "Wanna bet?" But depression wasn't the word. This was a plunge encompassing sorrow and revulsion far beyond the personal. A sick, drenching nausea at all humanity and human endeavor from the dawn of time. The writhing loathsomeness of the biological order. Old age, sickness, death. No escape for anyone. Even the beautiful ones were like soft fruit about to spoil. And yet somehow people still kept fucking and breeding and popping out new fodder for the grave, producing more and more new beings to suffer like this was some kind of redemptive or good or even somehow morally admirable thing, dragging more innocent creatures into the lose-lose game, squirming babies and plodding, complacent, hormone-drugged moms. "Oh, isn't he cute? Aw." Kids shouting and skidding in the playground with no idea what future hells awaited them. Boring jobs and ruinous mortgages and bad marriages and hair loss and hip replacements and lonely cups of coffee in an empty house and a colostomy bag at the hospital. Most people seemed satisfied with the thin decorative glaze and the artful stage lighting that sometimes made the bedrock atrocity of the human predicament look somewhat more mysterious or less abhorrent. People gambled and golfed and worked and prayed and planted gardens and traded stocks and had sex and bought new cars and practiced yoga and worked and prayed and redecorated their homes and got worked up over the news and fussed over their children and gossiped about their neighbors and pored over restaurant reviews and founded charitable organizations and supported political candidates and attended the U.S. Open and dined and traveled and distracted themselves with all kinds of gadgets and devices, flooding themselves incessantly with information and texts and communication and entertainment from every direction to try to make themselves forget it, where we were, what we were. But in a strong light, there was no good spin you could put on it. It was rotten, top to bottom. Putting your time in at the office, dutifully spawning your 2.5, smiling politely at your retirement party, then chewing on your bedsheet and choking on your canned peaches at the nursing home. It was better never to have been born, never to have wanted anything, never to have hoped for anything. And all this mental thrashing and tossing was mixed up with recurring images or half-dreams of Popchick leaning weak and thin on one side with his ribs going up and down. I'd forgotten him somewhere, left him alone and forgotten to feed him. He was dying. Over and over, even when he was in the room with me, head snaps where I started up guiltily, "Where is Popchick?" And this in turn was mixed up with head snapping flashes of the bundled pillowcase locked away in its steel coffin. Whatever reason I'd had for storing the painting all those years ago, for keeping it in the first place, for taking it out of the museum even, I now couldn't remember. Time had blurred it. It was part of a world that didn't exist. Or rather, as if I lived in two worlds, and the storage locker was part of the imaginary world rather than the real one. It was easy to forget about the storage locker, to pretend it wasn't there. I'd half expected to open it to find the painting vanished, although I knew it wouldn't be. it would still be shut away in the dark and waiting for me forever as long as I left it there, like the body of a person I'd murdered and stuck in a cellar somewhere. On the 8th morning, I woke sweat-drenched after 4 hours bad sleep, hollowed to the core, and as despairing as I'd ever felt in my life, but steady enough to walk Popchick around the block and come up to the kitchen and eat the convalescent's breakfast, poached eggs and English muffin, that Hobie pressed on me. And about time, too. He'd finished his own breakfast and was unhurriedly clearing the dishes, white as a lily. I'd be too, a week of soda crackers and nothing but. A bit of sunshine is what you are in need of, a bit of air. You and the pup should take yourselves out for a good long stroll. Right, but I had no intention of going anywhere except straight down to the shop, where it was quiet and dark. I haven't bothered you. You've been so low. His back-to-business voice, along with the friendly tilt of his head, made me look away uncomfortably and stare into my plate. But when you were out of commission, you had some calls on the home line.
Oh, yeah?
I'd switched my cell phone off and left it in a drawer. I hadn't even looked at it for fear of finding messages from Jerome. Awfully nice girl. He consulted the notepad, peering over the tops of his glasses. Daisy Horsley? Daisy Horsley was Carol Lombard's real name. Said she was busy with work. Code for fiancé around, stay away. And to text message her if you wanted to get in touch.
Okay. Great, thanks.
Daisy's big important National Cathedral wedding, if it actually went off, would be happening in June, after which she would be moving to D.C. with the B.F., as she called him.
Mrs. Hildesley called, too, about the cherry wood high chest. Not the bonnet top, the other. Countered with a good offer. 8,000. I accept it. I hope you won't mind. That chest isn't worth 3,000, if you ask me. Also, this fellow called twice. A Lucius Reeve?
I nearly choked on my coffee. The first I'd been able to stomach in days, but Hobie didn't seem to notice.
Left a number. Said you would know what it was about. Oh, he sat down suddenly, drummed the table with his palm. And one of the Barber children phoned.
Kitsy?
No, he took a gulp of his tea. Platt? Does that sound right?
12. The thought of dealing with Lucius Reeve, unmedicated, was just about enough to send me back to the storage unit. As for the barbers, I wasn't all that anxious to speak to Platt either, but to my relief it was Kitsy who answered.
We're going to have a dinner for you, she said immediately.
Excuse me?
Didn't we tell you? Oh, maybe I should have phoned. Anyway, Mum loved seeing you so much. She wants to know when you're coming back.
Well, do you need an invitation?
Well, sort of. You sound weird.
Sorry, I've had the, flu.
Really? Oh my goodness. We've all been perfectly fine. I don't think you can have caught it from us. Sorry?
She said to an indistinct voice in the background.
Here, Platt's trying to take the phone away. Talk to you soon.
Hi, brother, said Platt when he got on the line.
Hi, I said, rubbing my temple, trying not to think how weird it was for Platt to be calling me brother.
I, footsteps, a door shutting. I want to cut right to the chase.
Yes?
Matter of some furniture, he said cordially. Any chance you could sell some of it for us?
Sure. I sat down. Which pieces is she thinking of selling?
Well, said Platt, the thing is, I would really not like to bother Mommy with this, if possible. Not sure she's up for it, if you know what I mean.
Oh?
Well, I mean, she's just got so much stuff. Things up in Maine and out in storage that she'll never look at again, you know? Not just furniture. Silver, a coin collection. Some ceramics that I think are supposed to be a big deal, but, I'll be frank, look like shit.
I don't mean figuratively. I mean like literal clods of cow shit. I guess my question would be, why would you want to sell it?
Well, there's no need to sell it, he said hastily. But the thing is, she gets so tenacious about some of this old nonsense.
I rubbed my eye.
Platt. I mean, it's just sitting there, all this junk. Much of which is mine, the coins and some old guns and things because Gaga left them to me. I mean, crisply, I'll be frank with you. I have another guy I've been dealing with, but honestly, I'd rather work with you. You know us, you know Mommy, and I know you'll give me a fair price.
Right, I said uncertainly. There followed an expectant, endless-seeming pause, as if we were reading from a script and he was waiting with confidence for me to deliver the rest of my line, and I was wondering how to put him off when my eye fell on Lucius Reeve's name and number dashed out in Hobie's open, expressive hand.
Well, it's very complicated, I said. I mean, I would have to see the things in person before I could really say anything.
Right, right. He was trying to put in something about photos. But photographs aren't good enough. Also, I don't deal with coins, or the kind of ceramics you're talking about either. With coins especially, you really need to go to a dealer who does nothing but. But in the meantime, I said, he was still trying to talk over me, if it's a question of raising a few $1,000, I think I can help you out. That shut him up all right.
Yes?
I reached under my glasses to pinch the bridge of my nose. Here's the thing. I'm trying to establish a provenance on a piece. It's a real nightmare. Guy won't leave me alone. I've tried to buy the piece back from him. He seems intent on raising a stink. For what reason, I don't know. Anyway, it would help me out, I think, if I could produce a bill of sale proving I'd bought this piece from another collector.
Well, Mommy thinks you hung the moon, he said sourly. I'm sure she'll do whatever you want.
Well, the thing is, Hobie was downstairs with the router going, but I lowered my voice just the same. We're speaking in complete confidence, of course?
Of course.
I don't actually see any reason to involve your mother at all. I can write out a bill of sale and backdate it. But if the guy has any questions, and he may, what I'd like to do is refer him to you, give him your number. Eldest son, mother recently bereaved, blah, blah, blah.
Who is this guy?
His name is Lucius Reeve. Ever heard of him?
Nope.
Well, just so you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility that he knows your mother, or has met her at some point.
That shouldn't be a problem. Mommy hardly sees anyone these days.
A pause. I could hear him lighting a cigarette.
So, this guy phones.
I described the chest on chest. Happy to email a photo. The distinctive feature is the phoenix carving on the top. All you need to tell him, if he calls, is that the piece was up at your place in Maine until your mother sold it to me a couple of years back. She will have bought it from a dealer out of business, you see. Some old guy who passed away a few years back, can't remember the name. Darn, you'll have to check. Though if he presses, it was astonishing, I'd learned, how a few tea stains and a few minutes of crisping in the oven at low temperatures could further age the blank receipts in the 1960s receipt book I'd bought at the flea market. It'll be easy enough for me to provide that bill of sale for you, too.
I got it.
Right. Anyway, I was groping around for a cigarette, which I didn't have. If you take care of things on your end, you know, if you commit to backing me up if the guy does call, I'll give you 10% on the price of the piece.
Which is how much?
$7,000. Platt laughed, an oddly happy and carefree-sounding laugh.
Daddy always did say that all you antiques fellows were crooked.
13. I hung up the phone, feeling goofy with relief. Mrs. Barber had her share of second and third-rate antiques, but she also owned so many important pieces that it disturbed me to think of Platt selling things out from under her with no clue what he was doing. As for being over a barrel, if anyone gave off the aroma of being embroiled in some sort of ongoing and ill-defined trouble, it was Platt.
Though I had not thought of his expulsion in years, the circumstances had been so diligently hushed up that it seemed likely he'd done something fairly serious, something which in less controlled circumstances might have involved the police, which in a weird way reassured me, in terms of trusting him to collect his cash and keep his mouth shut. Besides, it gladdened my heart to think of it. If anyone alive could high-hand or intimidate Lucius Reeve, it was Platt, a world-class snob and bully in his own right. "Mr. Reeve?" I said courteously when he picked up the phone.
"Lucius, please."
"Well then, Lucius." His voice had made me go cold with anger, but knowing I had Platt in my corner made me more cocky than I had reason to be. "Returning your call. What's on your mind?"
"Probably not what you think," came the swift reply.
"No?" I said, easily enough, though his tone took me aback. "Well then, fill me in."
"I think you'd probably rather I do that in person."
"Fine. How about downtown?" I said quickly, since you were good enough to take me to your club last time. 14. The restaurant I chose was in Tribeca, far enough downtown that I didn't have to worry too much about running into Hobie or any of his friends, and with a young enough crowd, I hoped, to throw Reeve off balance. Noise, lights, conversation, relentless press of bodies. With my fresh, unblunted senses, the smells were overwhelming. Wine and garlic, and perfume and sweat. Sizzling platters of lemongrass chicken hurried out of the kitchen. And the turquoise banquettes, the bright orange dress of the girl next to me, were like industrial chemicals squirted directly into my eyes. My stomach boiled with nerves, and I was chewing an antacid from the roll in my pocket when I looked up and saw the beautiful tattooed giraffe of a hostess, blank and indolent, pointing Lucius Reeve indifferently to my table. "Well, hello," I said, not standing to greet him. "How nice to see you." He was casting his glance round in distaste.
"Do we really have to sit here?"
"Why not?" I said blandly. I deliberately chosen a table in the middle of traffic. Not so loud we had to shout, but loud enough to be off-putting. Moreover, had left him the chair that would put the sun in his eyes.
"This is completely ridiculous."
"Oh, I'm sorry. If you're not happy here..." I nodded at the self-absorbed young giraffe, back at her post and swaying absently. Conceding the point, the restaurant was packed, he sat down. Though he was tight and elegant in his speech and gestures, and his suit was modishly cut for a man his age, his demeanor made me think of a puffer fish, or, alternately, a cartoon strongman or Mountie blown up by a bicycle pump. Cleft chin, dough-ball nose, tense slit of a mouth, all bunched tight in the center of a face which glowed a plump, inflamed, blood pressure pink. After the food arrived, Asian fusion with lots of crispy flying buttresses of wonton and frizzled scallion, from his expression not much to his liking, I waited for him to work around to whatever he wanted to tell me. The carbon of the fake bill of sale, which I had written out on a blank page in one of Welty's old receipt books and backdated 5 years, was in my breast pocket, but I didn't intend to produce it until I had to. He had asked for a fork. From his slightly alarming plate of scorpion prawn, he pulled out several architectural filaments of vegetable matter and laid them to the side. Then he looked at me. His small, sharp eyes were bright blue in his ham-pink face.
"I know about the museum," he said.
"Know what?" I said, after a waver of surprise.
"Oh, please. You know very well what I'm talking about."
I felt a jab of fear at the base of my spine, though I took care to keep my eyes on my plate. White rice and stir-fried vegetables, the blandest thing on the menu. "Well, if you don't mind, I'd rather not talk about it. It's a painful subject."
"Yes, I can imagine."
He said this in such a taunting and provocative tone, I glanced up sharply. "My mother died, if that's what you mean."
Yes, she did.
Long pause.
Welton Blackwell did, too.
That's correct.
Well, I mean, written about in the papers, for heaven's sake. Matter of public record. But,
he darted the tip of his tongue across his upper lip.
Here's what I wonder. Why did James Hobart go about repeating that tale to everyone in town? You turning up on his doorstep with his partner's ring. Because if he'd just kept his mouth shut, no one would ever have made the connection.
I don't understand what you mean.
You know very well what I mean. You have something that I want. That a lot of people want, actually.
I stopped eating. Chopsticks halfway to my mouth. My immediate, unthinking impulse was to get up and walk out of the restaurant, but almost as quickly I realized how stupid that would be. Reeve leaned back in his chair.
You're not saying anything.
That's because you're not making any sense, I rejoined sharply, putting down the chopsticks, and for a flash, something in the quickness of the gesture, my thoughts went to my father. How would he handle this?
You seem very perturbed. I wonder why.
I guess I don't see what this has to do with the chest on chest, because I was under the impression that was why we were here.
You know very well what I'm talking about.
No, incredulous laugh, authentic sounding. I'm afraid I don't.
Do you want me to spell it out? Right here? All right, I will. You were with Welton Blackwell and his niece. You were all three of you in Gallery 32. And you,
slow, teasing smile,
were the only person to walk out of there. And we know what else walked out of Gallery 32, don't we?
It was as if all the blood had drained to my feet. Around us, everywhere, clatter of silverware, laughter, echo of voices bouncing off the tiled walls.
You see,
said Reeve smugly. He had resumed eating.
Very simple.
I mean, surely, he said in a chiding tone, putting down his fork.
Surely you didn't think no one would put it together. You took the painting, and when you brought the ring to Blackwell's partner, you gave him the painting, too. For what reason, I don't know.
Yes, yes, he said as I tried to talk over him, shifting his chair slightly, bringing up his hand to shade his eyes from the sun.
You end up James Hobart's ward, for Christ's sake. You end up his ward. And he's been farming that little souvenir of yours out hither and yon, and using it to raise money ever since.
Raise money? Hobie? Farming it out? I said, and then remembering myself.
Farming out what? This what's going on act of yours is beginning to get a bit tiresome.
No, I mean it. What the hell are you talking about? Reeve pursed his lips, looking very pleased with himself.
It's an exquisite painting,
he said.
A beautiful little anomaly. Absolutely unique. I'll never forget the first time I saw it in the Moritz House. Really quite different from any work there, or any other work of its day, if you ask me. Difficult to believe it was painted in the 1600s. One of the greatest small paintings of all time. Wouldn't you agree? What was it?
He paused, mockingly.
What was that, the collector said? You know, the art critic, the Frenchman, who rediscovered it? Found it buried in some nobleman's storeroom back in the 1890s, and from then on made desperate efforts,
inserting quotations with his fingers,
to acquire it. Don't forget, I must have this little goldfinch at any price.
But of course that's not the quote I mean.
I mean the famous one. Surely you must know it yourself. After all this time, you must be very familiar with the painting and its history.
I put down my napkin. I don't know what you're talking about. There was nothing I could do but hold my ground and keep saying it. Deny, 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 as my dad, in his one big movie turn as the mob lawyer, had advised his client in the scene right before he got shot.
But they saw me. Must have been somebody else. There are three eyewitnesses. Don't care. They're all mistaken. It wasn't me. They'll be bringing up people to testify against me all day long.